Hello and welcome to another episode of Africa in Transition. My name is Alan Grain and I am here with CFR Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies, John Campbell. We are joined by journalist and author Cheryl Strauss-Einhorn. Cheryl has recently released a book titled Problem Solved, A Powerful System for Making Complex Decisions with Confidence and Conviction. Cheryl, can you tell us what the purpose of Problem Solved is?
Absolutely. The concept is that we all grow up to be decision makers, and yet somehow there's no well-established way to make complex decisions well. But into our lives, we face at least a dozen of these. We face personal high-stakes decisions and professional high-stakes decisions. It could be anything from how to grow our business or expand our charity to thinking about how to help our aging parents find good living accommodations, switching careers. This week, seniors across the world are having to choose their college selection. And so we all need a way to work with and work through ambiguity. And my decision-making system is really the first system out there that is meant to control and counteract our mental shortcomings, the idea that we inherently are all flawed thinkers and use bias, assumption, and judgment, those things that we need in our everyday lives, but that don't go away when we're faced with complex problems.
I'm a policy person. And so what I would like to do is to make the jump from the personal to, if you like, international affairs, and with specific reference to Africa, and with even more specific reference to the fact that the UN estimates that there are 4.5 million people in the Chad Basin who face the prospect of famine. And even as we speak, there are at least 70,000, mostly children, who are dying of starvation. This is a policy conundrum. How can we apply some of the insights in your book to that specific real world issue? By we, I mean the United States.
Well, there's a lot going on in that question, and it's obviously a very terrible problem that unfortunately needed to be solved before it unfurled this way.
A very good point. In other words, this should have been addressed in the past.
That's right, because we do need a way, as I was saying before, to work with and work through ambiguity, and likely there were signs that this was evolving.
Oh, there were indeed.
And so the time to address this obviously was long ago, but it still needs to be addressed. And so actually there's two parts, right? There's the human behavior piece, and then there's also thinking about the data and the analysis.
Yes.
That need to go into evaluating the options that we have.
Yes.
And my decision-making system is called the AREA method, and AREA is an acronym for the steps of the process. But at its heart, the process is a perspective-taking process, and it is meant to address the human behavior piece, these assumptions and judgments and biases that not only we have as decision makers, but that also get at the incentives and the motivations of the other stakeholders in the problem. And this is obviously a situation where you need a holistic approach. And I think that at its heart is what good decision making is. If you want to have a high likelihood of success, you need to solve the problem holistically, and you need the perspective taking that allows you to look at the incentives and motivations of the others involved.
So the people that would be the target of this would be American policymakers,
mm-hmm.
UN policymakers, the policymakers in the Nigerian, Chadian, Cameroonian, and Nigerian governments,
mm-hmm. but very much also the local people and the local landscape. One of the key stories that drives my book, Problem Solved, is the story of a basic healthcare charity that was doing work in Nepal called the Oda Foundation. And interestingly, the CEO and founder of that organization read a textbook that I had written for the classes that I teach at Columbia that is based on my decision-making system because he knew one of my former students. Mm-hmm. And we met at the halls of Columbia Business School because he wanted to expand his charity. And 2 days later, the devastating earthquake hit Nepal. So we're talking about a situation that is different, but again, is a devastating natural disaster.
And parallel.
It's parallel. That needs an immediate response. And one of the fascinating things in working with John Christopher, the founder at the Oda Foundation, was that for all the years that he had operated in Nepal, when he was making policy and strategy decisions, he was thinking top down and wasn't canvassing and surveying the perspectives of the people he was actually serving. And that's not a holistic response. What he realized in the response that we worked on for him so that he could respond to this uncertain and volatile backdrop that immediately needed so much more of his basic healthcare services than it did days before was we had him go and actually talk to and understand what was preventing people in Nepal to date from using the government's services and healthcare clinics that are throughout the country, and what was it that actually made them walk for 16 hours for some of them to get to his clinics, and then what made them actually follow up on their care needs so that they could get well or they could have preventative care. And in a situation like this, all of the policymakers and getting their buy-in is obviously critical, but you can't do this without really understanding what's happening on the ground locally in these areas that are suffering.
And in northeastern Nigeria, you've got Boko Haram that continues to be active. They set off 4 bombs yesterday in Maiduguri. You have remarkably little on-the-ground intelligence because you can't get there. The UN estimates that of those in danger of starvation, they have no access to 700,000 of them because of Boko Haram activity. So that if, when you're talking about bottom up, there are enormous constraints. Possibly there's a parallel with the situation in Nepal. I just don't know. In that, by and large, people in the Lake Chad Basin are deeply suspicious of their governments, view their governments as exploitive. And there is some anecdotal evidence that at least some of them see little to choose between their government and Boko Haram.
Well, that's exactly right. And those are, unfortunately, those are the parallels of weak governments and fragile states. Mm-hmm. The people of Nepal turned out through John's area method research to tell him that the government system had a bad reputation because a lot of times the healthcare workers would not even show up and they would falsify the documentation about attendance. They also didn't have supplies that they should have had. The facilities weren't even open at times when they should have been. And this was a real problem. People were deeply suspicious and concerned that they either wouldn't get good quality of care or that they might not get good care at all. And I think this gets at another issue related to the perspective taking that's so important, which is that a lot of these weak infrastructures are prey to corruption. The people know it, and yet you're not going to be able to do away with the system that is in place.
That's exactly right.
And so the perspective taking becomes even more important because by understanding the incentives and motivations of the current system, you can think about changing the incentive structure, and you can also think about solving a situation that is actually going to lead to a successful outcome.
Implicit, it seems to me, in what you were saying, is that be it at the personal level or be it at the level of governments, an seemingly intractable issue like famine in the Lake Chad Basin requires attention, close attention, not dropping in and dropping out in response to a CNN clip, but sustained attention. How do we get that attention?
Well, as I was saying, AREA is an acronym, and the E part of the word AREA is actually two E's. It's exploration and exploitation, and I call these the twin engines of creativity. Exploration is about expanding your research breadth by moving beyond document-based research to develop sources and interview people who can give you the information that you can't get from documents. And then exploitation is about deepening your research and turning your lens in on yourself as a decision maker. And it has a series of exercises that I've learned from other disciplines, such as the intelligence community, investigative journalism, and medicine. And this is where you can really check your assumptions against your evidence. And the reason why that's important is you're saying you can't have a moment in time. You can't take a picture or a snapshot. You need sustained evaluation. And so what I would say is, in these exercises where you are thinking about your evidence against your hypotheses, what you're looking for is not the hypothesis that has the most confirming data lined up for it. You are looking for the one with the least disconfirming data. And the reason why
Oh, wait a minute. This is fascinating. So in other words, what you are saying is, with a hypothesis, you are not evaluating it from the perspective of confirming data. Rather, you are evaluating it from the perspective of the hypothesis that has the least amount of negative.
That's exactly right. And let me explain a little bit about that. Say you have a hypothesis that has a lot of evidence for it. You need to think about the diagnosticity of that evidence, because if you have even one insurmountable hurdle, it doesn't matter that you have a lot of other pieces of evidence that line up with that hypothesis. And so the most likely hypothesis, as I was saying, is usually the one with the least disconfirming data. Disconfirming data. And so these types of exercises I find personally are extremely useful. And in my teaching at Columbia, a lot of times my students will grumble about having to sit down and actually use a competing alternative hypothesis exercise or think about a scenario analysis for just two of the examples that I have in the book. But they almost always come away with not only a real aha, but they also find that it helps them to a certain extent to make their mistakes before they make them.
Yes.
And that's a beautiful thing to be able to do. In life, we don't get that many opportunities to do that. But these kinds of checks and balances can certainly help. And they also help you with the fact that AREA is a feedback loop, because not all investigations are linear, nor should they be. At times, you need more data or you need more analysis, and you need to be driven back into earlier parts of the process. To continue what we were talking about, John at the ODA Foundation, John had a very successful basic healthcare clinic in a very rural part of Nepal. And after the earthquake struck, one of his three options was to open a second clinic in a much more heavily populated area. And he just assumed that that was the most likely avenue that he would take to expand his charity's reach, because he'd already been successful. He made an assumption he would be successful again. When he got to this part of the process, exploitation, and he did his competing alternative hypothesis, he realized if he had opened that second clinic, he would have bankrupted his charity. He hadn't really thought about the sheer population in the catchment area for the new facility, nor had he really understood, even though he'd collected the data, he didn't recognize its import, that the kinds of sicknesses that the people were suffering from were really at that point beyond the core competency of the organization, which would mean that they would have had to have hired a different kind of staff with different training that they had. And it was a game changer for him.
Okay, so if we're talking about hypotheses are alternative strategies for addressing famine in the Lake Chad Basin, the biggest disconfirming element, which I think here is an extremely helpful concept, the biggest disconfirming issue is the lack of security, the continuing operations of Boko Haram, which means that the kind of ground-up acquisition of evidence becomes extraordinarily difficult, and it also colors quite dramatically the way the governments in the area respond. So that we, all the various hypotheses that are floating around, many of which have insight, in fact become largely irrelevant unless you can address this disconfirming issue, right? Or not?
No, I think that's right. And what you're picturing is not only terribly sad, but you're portraying a group that is probably motivated in part by fear. And
by what group are you referring to?
Well, if the governments themselves are very concerned about operating in these areas,
which they are,
because of security-related issues, that means that they're being governed in part by the fact that they are afraid with what response they're going to get. And I think this gets at the fact that these organizations like Boko Haram, part of the reason why, unfortunately, they're attractive to people is that they have pretty organized infrastructures.
Oh, yes, they do.
And in some cases, those organizational infrastructures are better than the government's.
Yes. And at least at various times.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so it really is a problem. And, you know, again, akin to the fact that, you know, after the earthquake hit in Nepal, you're not just worried that you can't just say that the earthquake is over. Mother Nature doesn't work that way, right? So you are going to have all sorts of destabilizing activities in the wake of that that you cannot foresee. And that's what you're talking about here, is a situation that you cannot foresee. But again, we don't want to be hobbled by uncertainty. The future is uncertain even when you don't have this added layer of security issue. And so you need a way to work with incomplete information. And to the extent that you are using perspective taking and you are thinking about the incentives and motivations of the different groups, you can still hopefully come up with what is success. Right, and that's the other thing that the area method does, is it inverts the whole idea of decision making. Instead of focusing on the problem, it says to you, can you picture success? Right?
Or what does success look like?
What does success look like? And what that gets at are your critical concepts, which are the one, two, or three things that really matter to you and the outcome, so that you're not solving for a complete unknown. You are solving to get towards your picture of success, which once you have imagined, you now can tell the story of it. And by identifying those critical concepts, the one, two, or three things that are part of that success, you can deeply and creatively investigate those things, so that hopefully you can come to conviction that you can actually have a decision that will have a high likelihood of success. You're not solving for all variables.
So you've outlined a problem here, or we've outlined a scenario where ideally our government or another government will proceed to deal with the situation in northern Nigeria. And then we've identified a key problem, and we know that this is the route that we're going to take. How would we work around the fundamental issue of security that would prevent the likelihood of success for most operations?
That's a very complex problem, right?
But how does this process help us deal with those problems?
Provides a framework for doing that.
Well, it doesn't just provide a framework for doing that, but in the final A analysis, the chapter focuses on thinking about mistakes. It thinks about solvability, and it also puts in place a way that you can help conduct an exercise called a pre-mortem that basically says, all right, imagine that your decision has failed, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Now, what is it that caused that decision to fail? Step by step, can you write down an outline for yourself? How did failure occur? And by imagining that your decision has already failed, not only can you hopefully put in place support so that that failure doesn't occur, but you've also now identified what are the key markers that I would look for to let me know that I am beginning to fail mm-hmm. in the decision that I've made. And I think that that's something that can really help us before we actually go forward with the decision so that we can further support its success.
So, for policymakers, the value of your book and the area methodology is it guides thinking about how to address a real-world problem. Let me also add for our audience that the case studies that she includes, that Cheryl includes, are quite fascinating. They are actually little mini novels, and it's a very good read. Cheryl, thank you so very much for coming in. Very much enjoyed it, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, Ambassador, for speaking with us today. And Cheryl, again, thank you for your input. And thank you for tuning in to Africa in Transition.